Lucy's dreaming.
Good day, Eternal Treasures. Welcome to episode 2 of Anthology 5 of the Lucid Dreaming Podcast. This anthology explores the resonances between works and makers of moving images. The Lucid Dreaming Podcast is hosted by author and curator Pamela Cohn. In this episode, we're coming to you with a percussive, discursive manner, an oral beat of the eardrum. So let's begin.
Hello, dreamers. Welcome to the Lucid Dreaming Podcast. I'm Pamela Cohn. In this episode, I'm so happy to be in conversation with Luke Fowler and Ernst Karel, two artists that have much admiration for one another and who have worked together in the past and hope to do so in the future. We thought they'd make marvelous conversation partners, and we weren't disappointed. Born in Glasgow, Scotland, where he lives and works, filmmaker and musician Luke Fowler has created a body of 16mm film work, each piece a celebration of a life told in a singular style. With an emphasis on communities or the communal experience, and thinkers and creators who have worked diligently in the margins of the wider culture, Luke is more interested in alternative movements and ways in which a creative person lives out his or her life. Like an archaeologist would do, he collects the fragments of what's left behind to sculpt a bespoke glimpse of a partial autobiography, captured through the apparatus of his camera lens. Many of his films feature musicians, composers, and composing as their subjects, and in his recent works in particular, sound itself has become a key preoccupation. Luke enjoys the art of creative collaboration as well, and for each of his projects, he partners with sound mixers, designers, and musicians. He's been a longtime participant in the experimental and electronic music scene in Glasgow, and has been in two bands, Rude Provo and Lead Music, and has run the small label Shadaz for over a decade. He's made films and installations with sound artists such as Lee Patterson, Toshiya Tsunoda, Mark Fell, Eric Lacaza, and Ernst Karel, using avant-garde experimentation as well as the tropes of politically radical documentaries from the 1960s and 70s in his oblique approach, engaging with whatever environment he's filming in, working with a certain knowledge that there is enormous complexity involved in representing a person's or a movement's life. Luke's latest works include 2021's For Dan, about a friend of his late father's, Dan O'Neill, 2020's Patrick, about revolutionary music producer Patrick Cowley, 2019's Houses, for Margaret, a tribute to Scottish filmmaker and poet Margaret Tate on her centenary, and Cézanne, a piece shot in and around the studio and garden of the painter Paul Cézanne in Aix-en-Provence. In 2017 to 2018, he made Mum's Cards, and a collaboration with sound recordist Chris Watson called Ancienne. It's re-recording mix created by Ernst Karel. Ernst also worked as the sound editor and mixer on Luke's Electro Pythagoras, a portrait of Canadian composer Martin Bartlett, an artist who pioneered the use of the microcomputer in music composition and performance. After the film's premiere at the Sonic Axe Festival in Amsterdam, Luke and Ernst performed a live four-channel performance of Glyphs, music for Martin's tape archive. Ernst Karel works with sound, including electroacoustic music, experimental nonfiction sound works for multi-channel installation and performance, image sound collaboration, and post-production sound for nonfiction film, with an emphasis on observational cinema. His latest projects emphasize working with fields recording and using those recordings in composing soundscapes. From 2006 to 2017, Ernst managed the Sensory Ethnography Lab at Harvard University, doing post-production sound for films including Elisa Barbash and Lucien Castagne-Taylor Sweetgrass, J.P. Sniadecki's The Iron Ministry, Stephanie Spray and Pacho Velez's Monica Mana, and Lucien Castagne-Taylor and Verena Paravel's Leviathan. He developed and teaches a practice-based course in sonic audio ethnography at Harvard, as well as through the Center for Experimental Ethnography at the University of Pennsylvania. Ernst's most recent work is a feature film, which has its first theatrical run at Anthology Film Archives in New York, called Expedition Content, made in collaboration with anthropologist Veronica Kuzumaryati. The film had its world premiere at the 2020 Berlinale in Forum Expanded. The 78-minute film unfolds as an extended sound piece, the only visuals in the film from an outtake of Robert Gardner's Dead Birds. Other than that, the only other visual cues are occasional flashes of blue and translations of some of the Hubula dialogue we hear. The sound recordist on this anthropological mission, organized in 1961 by Robert Gardner, called the Harvard Peabody Expedition to Netherlands, New Guinea, current-day West Papua, with the intention to carry out, quote, a comprehensive study of a single community of Neolithic warrior farmers, unquote, was Michael Rockefeller, who disappeared, his whereabouts never discovered. In an interview at the film's Berlinale premiere, Kuzumaryati said, "This is the last phase in the field of social anthropology where you sent a group of scientists, photographers, and filmmakers to document one single community. At Harvard, there's an extensive and overwhelming archive that's available of sound, film, visuals, photographs, and paper archives. In light of the disappearance of Rockefeller and the situation in West Papua today, this is an archive that really calls for artists or filmmakers or anthropologists to work on." Expedition Content is composed from this archive, 37 hours of tape that document the oral encounter between the Harvard Peabody Expedition and the Hubula people. Ernst did the sound edit and mix for Robert Gardner's 2013 film, Two Sons of Catalonia, Joseph Louis Sert and Joan Miró. Gardner passed away the following year, with Ernst taking on the mantle in part of his legacy, albeit in a profoundly different time, space, and culture. There's much to talk about in the coming hour, so let's get started. Welcome to the Lucid Dreaming Podcast, and Ernst.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure to have you both here. In line with the conversation going on just before we started recording, you both talk so eloquently about the apparatus, about the recording apparatus, and particularly, I mean, Ernst, you said in an interview recently, "I'm really interested in hearing that mic." There was this conversation of, in line with Expedition Content, that it's all about a mic, both right. The apparatus and the person operating that. Right. And I would love for the two of you to sort of share more of how you feel that your relationship to the various apparatuses you use has matured, developed, how it's changed perhaps as you move through your practices, and where and when the sophistication or lack of sophistication in an apparatus benefits the mood, the emotion that you're trying to evoke in the work.
You know, that's a really interesting question, Pamela. I was talking about use of the archive earlier with a friend who's just made an archival documentary about Throbbing Gristle and Coombe transmissions. And I was saying that I couldn't afford to license archival material anymore because it's become a kind of new gold rush. And, you know, everyone is so obsessed with monetizing whatever intellectual property they may own or have inherited that there isn't anymore, I feel, a friendly and generous dialogue between artists and rights holders anymore, and that has, you know, it's become monetized, the relationship has become monetized, and that has meant that I have had to practically stopped licensing archival footage, except when it is on a relationship, a personal relationship with the rights holder. They're either a friend or it's not an institutional relationship where I'm working through a go-between or a middle person. So that has definitely changed my relationship to filmmaking, and it's meant that I've had to rely much more on my own first-person filmmaking, on my use of the Bolex, and more recently of an Arri 16mm camera that I started using with respect and in honor of Peter Hutton, the filmmaker who I worked with on a film. He came to it was a film called The Poor Stockinger, and he came to England, to Yorkshire, to work on this film together, and we stayed in touch ever since and until his passing. And Peter worked with this antique Arri 60s film camera, and he said that he preferred it to a Bolex, although he started with a Bolex, but he said he preferred this camera to the Bolex because he could create the kind of stationary image that is without gate weave, that was more likely to occur with the Bolex, the gate weave that is, because of the extra pin registration that you have on the Arri system. And also, I mean, you can shoot magazines, which you can with the Bolex, but I've never seen anyone shoot a magazine with the Bolex. I think actually when I was at Harvard Film Center, what's the acronym again?
The Film Studies Center.
Film Studies Center, yeah. Ernst showed me Robert's camera, and it was the same camera.
Robert Gardner's old Arri?
Robert Gardner's camera.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, it was the exact same camera. And since I have seen more people use them, but it is talking about, you know, the apparatus and how that engenders a response. I mean, it completely changed my filmmaking using this camera, even though it's still 16mm, but just the way just the shift to a motor, and away from this clockwork and having to use a battery. You know, it's an electronic camera that requires a battery, and also the use of the magazine. It just completely changed my relationship to time and film time and duration, shot length. And I realized, I also found it very hard to do the things that I did on a Bolex, like fades and rewinds and superimpositions, because when you do those things on an Arri, because of the magazine, it can kind of jam more easily. I found even though the engine has a rewind setting on it, like I just found it was less tactile. Because you have this motor, you know, that's running. For sure, I think that the apparatus engenders the way that I make films, and you know, that's not even getting into discussing digital or video. But I've also noticed, as a sort of footnote to this, that my films change when I edit them manually on a bench, as to when I edit them on a computer with a digital intermediate, a digital transfer. With the digital, the difference being very simply that with the by hand, and I don't even have a Steinbeck, but you know, when I do it on a set of rewinds, then you just basically have to work with what you have. You know, it's very simplistic. It's very simple, and it's time consuming, and it's quite meditative. You know, this act of just, you know, you can't watch the film over and over again, because you know, to watch it, you have to string it all together and project it. So you're relying much more on your memory of the image And you know, you have to be a lot more exacting, and you can't make, you know, it's much harder to, like, you know, it's destructive editing. So you have to be very precise about the decisions that you're going to make before you make them. And in digital, you know, I can just edit all day and watch all day. And
so, but what, in your opinion, are the pitfalls of that? Perhaps
the pitfalls being that you think less, and you use memory less, and you use your eyes more.
Right.
You know, you're constantly micro editing, and
right.
Whereas with the manual editing, you have to do either the edit on paper, or you know, you just have to be brutal and coarse and not granular in your decision making. And that has an energy to it, and it has a look to it that I think is kind of a quality that one could probably, if they were a really intent film scholar, could probably tell the difference between which films are being edited and on an analog table and which have been edited in digital.
Ernst, any thoughts?
So yeah, building on that idea of wanting to hear the mic. It's interesting, Luke, talking about the situation with archives. I've done a lot less work with archives than Luke has, but have done some recent work, especially Expedition Content, the recent project with Veronica Kusumariati. And that, it has changed my working with other people's recordings, which I also do when I work on people's films, like Luke's films and so on, does change. I think it has changed my way of thinking about the relationship with the mic or with the material. Some of my earlier projects, sound projects like Heard Laboratories, were sort of, for me, coming out of my previous experiments in sound had been really kind of noise electronics and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And what I was fascinated with in those days was the way in which a wonderful sounding pair of mics, in that case, like Shep's, you know, German made microphones, and a nice recorder could reveal all of this detail in a field of noise. And, you know, so you could really like create what I sometimes think of as like a noise documentary, you know, or like a really getting into the details of what's really to a certain way of listening, you know, a mass of undifferentiated sound, but becomes differentiated in a way because of the qualities of these microphones, you know, and because of the nice, you know, stereo pair that they're arranged in and so on. Having worked on subsequent projects where detail, I think the way of thinking about detail takes a different form. So detail doesn't necessarily mean verisimilitude or fidelity or anything like that, but rather, even with, you know, a poor quality microphone, you're getting a lot of detail there. It's just, where is the detail and what's the shape of that detail and what are the implications of that detail? For example, in Expedition Content, that detail has a lot to do not with a transparent window onto reality or something like that, which, you know, we don't think of anymore, but has to do with that situatedness, with the limited nature of it, the partial view, the handheld, you know, the wind hitting that capsule, and all of that, which says so much about the situation, much more in a way than a transparent, so-called transparent window onto reality would show. And so, yeah, so moving on from working on those kind of projects and thinking about recording myself now, what you're doing is listen, you're sort of choosing, in choosing a microphone or choosing how you're going to record a certain thing, you're kind of selectively listening to that thing and the way it resonates with the equipment. And that combination of selective listening, selective resonance, and so on, are all part of building sort of what you were describing as the affect or emotion or mood of a recording. And I think that sometimes comes out actually in the act of recording, but much more often for me comes out afterwards in listening back and kind of discovering what actually happened there when I was in that place with that microphone. And then that kind of affect or mood or sensibility emerges at that point later, even after the recording, during the listening back and selection process.
Can I interject with one quick point about what Ernst was saying? I was listening to Expedition content today and I was a bit perplexed about the timeline, and I had to look up something. I had to Wikipedia fact check, because the recordings are made in 1969, right? Or 61. And the first recordings that I hear, correct me if I'm wrong, Ernst, but I'm absolutely positive I hear stereo recordings in there. And then I had to look up when the Nagra released their first stereo recorder, which was 1971. So I thought, this is all recorded with a Nagra 3, which is a mono recorder. So how am I listening to stereo? And then I thought, Ernst has done something tricky with this, or has done something fancy with this. And I kind of wanted him to reveal or discuss that, because again, that's against the transparency of the recording, which is very much embedded within the piece, the slating, the clicks of the recorder being turned on and off. And then we do hear recordings in mono, and then we hear them kind of flipping from one channel to another channel. But I'm absolutely positive that we hear in stereo at one point. I wonder if you could throw some light onto that.
Yeah. Thanks for the careful listening. It does have to do with the magic of post-production. You're right. But I don't see it as a contradiction, because yes, certainly on the one hand, we wanted to approach that material very straightforwardly, and sort of what you're hearing is what you get, to the extent that a lot of the cuts, and I'll say a lot and not all, but a lot of the cuts are motivated more by the length of the shot as recorded than by our decision about where to cut it, you know. So we'll use those ins and outs of when the tape recorder was, you know, engaged and when it was stopped and so on as cut points throughout. At the same time, we did want it, like if you listen to it in the theater, which is what we composed it for the cinema, most of the mono material is coming out of the single center, you know, speaker in the cinema, which is perfect for mono. And there's occasionally places where, on the one hand, we're interested in this kind of, you could say, faith or, you know, truth in materials kind of approach, where, you know, we're not doing anything fancy for the most part, and the viewer or listener, in a way, you know, trusts that we are, what they're hearing are tapes from that archive and so on. However, at the same time, there are places, like Luke has pointed out, where we are nodding towards the fact that this is completely constructed. There's no trying to hide that at all. And some places we're just having a good time with audio. And one of those places is the very first shot, that kind of photography lesson at the beginning, where in a way, partially we treated that differently because it's the one thing that was actually recorded before they went to West Papua. So it sort of appears briefly in the center and then zooms out to the left, you know, or like pans out to the left. But what is panned to the right at the same time, and why it gets that stereo effect, is there was this kind of odd whistling resonance in the tape somehow, kind of whirring sound that was there. And just for sake of Well, I don't know why, but we panned the audio, the main audio, hard to one side to indicate that we're not in West Papua yet. And then in the right, I filtered out and isolated that whirring sound, which still has a little burble of the conversation in it, but it, it does create a wide stereo effect. But yeah, that is from a mono tape. And there's a few different kind of, you could call them tricks or little things that happen throughout that are complicating the straightforwardness of just mono tapes. Like when you hear one mono recording in the left and another mono recording in the right, or, and then in the case of the thunderstorm sequence, there's mono recordings in each of the three channels. Like it really gets dense at a certain point, and certain things like that that indicate the constructiveness of the piece.
The perfume of sound. So as Walter March once said about the air around the recording.
Speaking of that, the way in which you approach this kind of biography, let's say, right, of a certain subject, a certain presence, a certain moment in time, and all the things that are left behind of that person, the traces of that life, it's almost archaeological in nature, you know, and it's almost antithetical to, I think, this kind of nod to ethnography or this nod to, you know, the very troubled aspects of anthropology, et cetera. Instead, both of you have this really beautiful sort of, I would say, archaeological way of when you're working alone, but also when you're working in collaboration, because both of you collaborate with so many people on so many different levels. A collaboration even being amongst a living presence and one that's past. And both of both projects, recent projects of yours, you know, encounter that kind of ghostly presence that really is our narrator. He or she is really our storyteller in a sense. And that word storyteller somehow has become a bit, you know, bastardized in a way and looked down upon. But I mean, this is what it is all about, is that story. Not being able to be told, impossible to be told in this normal sort of linear narrative way we're used to taking in information about what a person was, what they did, who they were, what kind of impact did they leave behind. And I'd love for both of you in your own way or to each other to talk about, you know, the sort of initial like spark of joy that that engendered in you, you know, that you could sort of make this kind of connection with the ineffable. Because I think film and video and music are the art forms that can most, you know, make that kind of reach. And since you're both musicians and you both have this sort of sense of timbre to everything, I would love for you to talk about those ideas in the sense, again, of just being in your studio and figuring things out to the way in which you might collaborate with another artist.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there about, you know, this ineffable quality to filmmaking. And that's what I'm kind of striving towards when I make films. And there's this book, I can't remember who it's by, it's called Robert somebody, but I think it's called Story. You probably have come across this book. So many people quote this book, and it's about the kind of quintessential mythological nature of storytelling, right? That we tell stories in order to be able to understand each other. And historically, you know, the function of narrative in fables and myths. And, you know, for me, I've actually, and then you talked about archaeology, you know, the sense of digging and revealing sort of, you know, ghosts or confronting ghosts. And, you know, for me, it's always been about not writing a story and not seeking a story. And that doesn't mean to say that there isn't some kind of narrative element to my films or narrative structure, but I feel that something happened with documentary and with film that it became to be so pre-digested, such a sort of format-led template that we have lost what is the essence of making film. And if you look back to even, you know, Zygmunt Vertov or the Russians, and even to, there was this pamphlet or essay written by a psychologist at Harvard called Hugo Mustenberg. Have you come across him, Ernst? And he wrote this piece called The Photoplay.
No, I don't think so.
And I this was just in my, I opened my notebook and it came up with this 1916, the four fundamentals belonging to the experience of the cinema: attention, memory, imagination, and emotion. You know, and this is in 1916 by a psychologist. This isn't film theorist. This isn't Deleuze, you know. This a psychologist writing about the nature of film. And I somehow feel that those, we maybe focus more, so much more on the emotional aspect of filmmaking and the crutch of the emotion and sort of appeasing the audience, that the fidelity to lived experiences is lost. And that's always been the thing that has driven me in making film, is sort of, I think about, you know, the cornerstone, like Wavelength, you know, by Michael Snow, and this, his analogy to consciousness, filmmaking being in this sort of analogy to consciousness, or a mirror to consciousness, of, he has narrative elements, tropes coming in and out. There's a murder in it, you know. You can't get more kind of hammy than that and dramatical than that. Like, but then there's also this, you know, there's past, present, and future going on. And so I think, you know, yeah, I've always sort of been interested in how we can complicate modes of filmmaking from just this linear, biographical, or mythological narrative arc that we're so conditioned to watching.
I mean, you mentioned the word attention, which I think is a really important word in all this, and that's sort of like anti-attention, in a sense, if we're constantly fed, pre-digested, as you said, content, there is no need to pay attention. And I think, you know, that sort of speaks to perhaps the way a filmmaker might work, which is sort of in an anti-attention mode. The author of Story, by the way, is Robert McKee, not Robert Stone. I just didn't want to get like hate mail that I am this iconic book and I said the wrong name. So I just wanted to
never read
clarify
it.
That.
I'm hands up, never read it. And I kind of, maybe I should.
It doesn't sound like you ever will. Ernst, any thoughts?
I think I see things a lot like similarly to the way Luke was describing. Again, not being completely opposed to the idea of story. I mean, that's kind of how our minds work, is we're constantly constructing stories and but getting at your, what was just being said about attention and so forth, I think the point to emphasize about that is that it's about our minds working and constructing stories. And so therefore, as a filmmaker or as a maker of something to listen to, we don't need to take that as a responsibility to create a complete story, because stories will happen no matter what. And in a way, that's part of what I tried to do with, I mean, Luke did it beautifully with the Martin Bartlett film, for example. It's just little glimpses of, you know, a lot of those short shots which indicate the immensity of what's sort of behind each shot that you'll never have any chance to read completely. Some of those shots that have text on the screen, for example, or, you know, but there's this sense of a life that's so far beyond what a single story could be about that life. And similarly with, I think work that I try to make, what I celebrate is the partiality of what is being presented and the sort of like trying to create a space for a listener or viewer or whatever to engage, and that, and allowing for that engagement to have that space, you know, so that it's not pre-digested, as you were saying. And if there's not a linear narrative, that doesn't help, that doesn't hinder the viewer or listener's ability to engage associatively or in any kind of creative way with the material. In fact, hopefully it it supports that.
Recording of natives yelling in the back cave at the end of the Mimi River.
So, in line with that, what did can you just tell me what your interpretation is of sonic ethnography? This sort of, like, you're smiling, but yeah. It's a very captivating idea because, well, again, like all the ologies, each discipline, you know, has its own, you know, troubled history. And we're always, you know, the work that you're doing, particularly, you know, looking back on what Gardner and crew did, is always this, you know, revisitation of something, but from where we are now. And so, I don't know, this idea of even that word, you know, ethnography, I just would love to hear your thoughts on that.
I'm just looking around my room here because there's a, I just got in the mail a few days ago a new book called something like Audiovisual and Digital Ethnography or something that has a wonderful chapter in it called Sonic Ethnography by Andrew Littlejohn, who's now teaching at Leiden and was also a student in the first in the class the first time I taught a class with that title, Sonic Ethnography, about 10 years ago. And he defines it really nicely there. So I was going to see if I could grab his definition. The aspect of that that I would maybe mention is that it's, I think of it as not a codified field, or there's no single way of going about such a thing, but that it's more a proposal. And he actually brings up this idea too, that Andrew Littlejohn, that it's a sort of proposal for a way of working, or a proposal that that calls for experiments, which can be done in the form of sound, which in the form of audio, works of audio that may or may not be successful. And so this is, I think, the I'm also happy to see this phrase experimental ethnography being used more and more these days. Mm-hmm. For example, at Penn or with Stephanie Spray, who's now the director of the Center for Visual Anthropology at USC, has a new program in experimental ethnography, you know, so sort of bringing the experimental aspect to the forefront in sort of this particular aspect of documentary work, audiovisual work, which is, you know, ethnographic. The ethnographic aspect of sonic ethnography, I think, has a lot more to do with a sort of attitude or approach to the work, which centers on an engagement, a situation of engagement with a place, a situation, whatever it might be. So the idea of sonic ethnography is not so much about a work, like the audio work itself functioning ethnographically, although it can be about that, but more about the process of making the work, about the kind of, the way one engages with a site or a situation or a person or a group of people or whatever it might be. And that engagement happens both at the, not only at the time of recording, but also that engagement is reenacted and made more deep at the time of reviewing the recordings, finding out what actually happened in those recordings, and then again at the time of sort of selecting and editing those recordings, putting one in juxtaposition with another. These are all ways of deepening that initial engagement and making it more complex. And mm-hmm. those are the aspects I think that are of interest in kind of, not just in sonic ethnography, but in kind of certain kinds of filmmaking as well, that are about an authentic engagement and what are the repercussions of that authentic engagement in terms of what ended up happening, what ended up being reflected onto the film or showing up on the video file, or how did the vibrations of that mic, again, going back to hearing the mic, mm-hmm. create a signal that ended up on the tape. All mm-hmm. of that is part of this multi-species, multi-living, non-living, whatever we want to say, kind of, you know, holistic engagement with of person, equipment, air, wind, other beings, human and non-human, and so on. All of that is kind of comes together. And so that kind of attitude, I think, or way of engaging is how I think of sonic ethnography.
Yeah, there is, I mean, as I'm listening to you talking there, I'm realizing too how much of sort of the anesthetic version, you know, we get to all that. I think, you know, most sound mixes or sound editing is about stripping away, and you're sort of bidding for the fullness, you know, I guess, of a almost a 360 experience. I mean, you know, this, or if not 360, you know, at least still multi-directional,
yeah.
at least still giving the spectator or the listener a choice, right?
Yeah.
Maybe yeah. I could butt in there.
Of course you can.
I was wondering what role subjectivity plays in all of this, because, you know, we're talking about making decisions based on the material. And when you removed, as you said, that the fallacy of a singular truth. So if the recordings or the engagement with the material is no longer in a simple chronological basis of structuring, and we're also perhaps not going for a completely cagey and indeterminate, you know, I Ching, let the dice decide the structure, you know, at what point where does subjectivity sit within all this then, in terms of decision making?
I think it's all subjectivity all the way down. It's all relationality. It's not at all trying to pretend I'm not part of this equation. It's fully sitting in one's place and engaging relationally with what's going on around. And as Pamela was saying, yeah, in the depth of what's happening around. So not necessarily like I wouldn't, you know, 360 conjures up sort of virtual reality headsets for me.
A different yeah. immersion, yeah.
But it's definitely like, even with a single microphone, you have the relationality of, you know, foreground and background, what's happening where. I mean, with a stereo pair of microphones, that becomes much more enlivened in terms of those depths. And yeah, it quickly escapes as Chion, the film sound theorist, always points out, you know, it escapes beyond the frame if we're putting it in relationship to image. Even a single speaker, you know, fills the room with sound. But yeah, so subjectivity is 100% of what's going on.
And how do we challenge and detect the blind spots in our subjectivity then? Especially if ethnography is you know, a precedent to this, where which has been highly criticized as being apolitical.
Yeah, I think that's been criticized for a long time, and a lot of the trends in anthropology now are explicitly addressing that. I mean, going back to the so-called writing culture movement of the 80s, where they first were talking about the subjectivity that's at the heart of the enterprise, and the false the false idea that you're reporting something objectively at all. That goes back mm-hmm. a long ways, and especially now with, you know, for example, visual anthropology being relabeled as multimodal anthropology under, you know, Deborah Thomas's leadership at the American Anthropological Association, you know, this kind of like looking like, okay, multimodal meaning not just audio and video and text and so on and these kind of modes, but actually like different kinds of engagement with subjects and subjectivity and collaboration and participation, you know, across, you know, and so really moving far away from this model of the authoritative ethnographer who's going to tell somebody else's story for them. Yeah, I think that obviously anthropology has a long way to go, and part of, you know, one of the subtexts maybe of expedition content is sort of pointing out that the problems of anthropology are also part of our history of visual anthropology, so-called, that there's a similar set of issues involved and some institutional critique there. But I feel like those critiques are being addressed. I mean, those are valid critiques for sure, but they're being addressed widely.
Well, I think too, you address them specifically through Robert Gardner and through the way in which you include that talk they have and the way they're talking. And I don't know, it's not throwing a wrench in the work so much as just, again, shifting perspective. Even my emotional reaction listening to that part of it, which seemed to be a little bit detached from the rest of the film, but, you know, part and parcel of what was going on, was this, I felt discomforted throughout the film, I must say, in a good way. Mm-hmm. but that was a different type of feeling there. And when the colleagues are speaking among themselves, they've been drinking, you know, it's kind of like a no holds barred conversation where, you know, today they would just get in a whole heap of trouble. But then, you know, that was just what they were, how they were perceiving the world and how they were perceiving themselves against that world. They were encountering. I just thought that was a really sort of brave thing to do in a sense, because it creates this whole other conversation. I mean, Luke, you do this with your films as well. In almost every single film, there is that moment, whether it's visual or audio or the two sort of, you know, rubbing up against each other, that have this like specific attention to that moment, that isn't necessarily, you know, part and parcel of everything else that's going on. I mean, I have certain shots that come to mind, or even in Mum's Cards when, you know, your mother says this sort of amazing thing. She says, "I don't want to separate culture from society. I think that we have to think of the whole lot together. It's a product of a false specialization to split them off." And I think that's exactly what we're talking about, and the sort of danger zones of that, particularly these days. It gets quite sticky sometimes, particularly in the confines of an institution. I am always captivated by the thought of the artist within an institution. It's a very, you know, interesting position to be in as a creator, as someone getting in touch with something, you know, deep within you, again, that ineffable quality that makes you an artist in the first place, that makes you desire to make and create, versus this responsibility, I suppose you could say, as artists who have come to be also to have a very important voice. And that voice is disseminated, you know, and I'm just curious to know if you feel the weight of that, if it's something that is somewhat maybe of a burden to you, or whether it's a place of distinct privilege, you know, to be able to, and I don't mean that in the political sense, I just mean that it's a great thing that you're able, you know, to sort of live this expansive creative life within certain confines. I mean, do those constraints, like the constraints in the work, you know, help you or hinder you in ways that keep surprising you, that keep leading you forward into the next project?
I mean, yeah, so for, you know, 11 years I worked at the Film Study Center and the Sensory Ethnography Lab at Harvard, which is, you know, how, you know, a number of these kinds of things came about. How I met Luke is through that. He was there as a fellow at the mm-hmm. Film Study Center, and how I collaborated with Lucien Castaing-Taylor and Lisa Barbash and Verena Paravel and others. And obviously how I came to work on the archive for Expedition Content had to do with the fact that I was there at the Film Study Center, which was an organization founded by or co-founded by Robert Gardner. So that leads, there to be a sort of feeling of responsibility in working with that material, not to simply carry on what the institution had kind of supported in the past, but to, in a way, to critique the institution itself. But I don't know how to address that question about being in a position where the work gets out there.
But you kind of carved out a niche for yourself within the institution that allowed you to do what you wanted to do on your own terms. And I have a huge admiration for that, and that you weren't, you know, employed to teach a course on sound recording or on sound in film. You know, you made up a role for yourself that was basically what you wanted to do. And it opens up so many different avenues in my mind about, you know, impossible answers about like residencies and teaching and PhDs, artists doing PhDs, and like, you know, the academicization of arts whether artists can still be free to set their own agendas, free of the institutional pressure. And I see more and more like so that we aren't free. Perhaps we've never been free. We've always been bounded within economic constraints of having to make a living. But there was a point on the welfare state in Britain, at least, where, you know, you could forego any kind of luxury, but, you know, have a meager existence that allowed you to make your work on your own terms. And the state played a role in that, and a crucial arm's length relationship to the artists. And now that I see that arm's length process withering, and I wonder what influence that is having, in the same way that, you know, we critique the market's detrimental role in the arts. And now we could say, you know, with the same hand, perhaps the academy is having the same influence.
But I guess, you know, I mean, the question is more, you know, knowing this structure could exist to support you initially, I would think would be a very positive thing. But, you know, the way in which, I guess, artists today feel they have to navigate versus, you know, an almost an obligation to sort of follow a certain path. And I just feel, you know, in some way your methodologies and the way you work filmically, particularly, sort of really encourage quite the opposite. But I think that's also inimical to probably your upbringing and what you saw and took in, you know, that those impressions I feel are still very strong there, in you, Luke, especially. I always feel this sort of, I don't know, maybe it's the materiality of the work, but this strangely nostalgic pull that, you know, I don't know, takes things down to their very essence, which is a very, very beautiful thing to see, rather than the pile on, you know, of audiovisual work that layers it so much that it sort of loses its authenticity altogether. And that's something I deeply appreciate about your work. In wrapping up, do you have plans to collaborate again? Is there a desire to, you know, tap into one another's brain pans on a regular basis? And what that collaboration in particular really has given you?
Always. It's a complete delight to work with Ernst. And, you know, I found myself reading, I'm sort of almost feel like this is a sort of guilty confession here, but reading an interview with Ernst that he did, it's online and it's in transcript form, and just how it just sort of how edifying that experience was, and how connected I felt to the things that Ernst was talking about in terms of this shift in filmmaking, you know, or how he was talking about pre-linguistic, this sort of idea of not of making films that didn't rely on works of art, sonic or auditory or filmic, that didn't rely on the spoken, on the verbal communication. Mm-hmm. To me, that is something that I'm always struggling with. It's a perennial problem, how to evacuate the voice as the main signifier of meaning, and how to let other worlds, let other modes of existence, of being, of thought, of the ocular and this, the auditory and the conscious, the subconscious, to have all these different modes of perception create the works, rather than relying on this crutch of the verbal storyteller. Getting back to the start of our conversation.
Well, thanks, Luke, and it sounds like we have the beginnings of a new collaboration already starting here, which would be fantastic. We'll make a work that explores these ideas or tries to build on them. Obviously, there's so many possibilities for ways of working in image and sound, you know, that go well beyond the linguistic, the musical, all these things that even the clearly formed, where we have an idea of what's going on. I mean, you were talking about earlier, to go back to the beginning of the conversation in another way, Luke, when you were talking about the Ari camera affording you different ways of thinking about duration itself. I think one of the things that we do in, you know, it's sort of needless to say, but to say, you know, when we're making time-based work, is creating durations, you know, and durations that include suggestions of certain kinds, or include certain kinds of parameters, certain kinds of possibilities, you know. And of course, we don't know how those durations will be received or engaged with. And that's another aspect of indeterminacy, which Luke brought up earlier, is not even so much in the compositional process, but we're creating a space of indeterminacy for, you know, the viewer or listener, where they might interpret it in a way that we think that is what we would experience if we were experiencing this work, but they might experience it a very different way. And a lot of the kinds of work that we're talking about, that Luke and I are engaged with, are open in that sense. The works are open to indeterminate participation. Yeah.
What are we going to do with all this openness? Well, thank you both very, very much. Thank you, Ernst, and thank you, Luke, for joining me this hour. It's been a delight.
Thanks so much for having us. And thanks for starting our next collaboration.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's all for this episode, listeners. We'll return next week in conversation with filmmakers Jessica Kingdon and Kim Longinotto. Lucid Dreaming is a production of Lono Studio, hosted by Pamela Cohn. If this is your first time listening, do subscribe and leave us a review. Goodbye, dreamers!